All right. Well, okay. So we're back on Red Letter Series. So I guess we had suspended this series clear back before the Spring Holy Days. And then, of course, we went on the Israel trip, and then we did the review of the Israel trip. And so, it was clear back in March where we had part 41. Part 41, we finished Matthew 25. So today we're going to take a look at Matthew 26 and, of course, any corresponding gospels that cover the same material. Now, kind of in order to get us back on track mentally, remember we are doing this series because we want to look at the actual words of God. You know, Yeshua came as very God in the flesh, and I've said many times that if there was a meeting of theologians in a room discussing points of doctrine and Yeshua walked in, the debate at least would be over, wouldn't he? I mean, he's God. He gets the last word. So it behooves us then to get his words in us. We want to make sure that we understand his words and make certain then that when we are reading anything else, that we don't allow his words to be undermined, right? So this series is really important. It's why we've taken so much time with it. There is so much confusion, so much misinformation, false doctrines, and deceptions out there because this simple principle is not applied where we just sit at the feet of God, listen to Him first and foremost, and not let anything else come into disagreement with it. We take everything else in context and in agreement with the very words of God. So with that in mind, we can kind of jump back into it here. Matthew 26 begins with preparations for Passover. Okay? It has the coverage of the events of Christ's betrayal by Judas, of his arrest, of the beatings, of coming, you know, before the different authorities, and of course his eventual crucifixion and resurrection. And of course much of this also is covered in the other Gospels as well. And you know, that whole ordeal we call the passion of the Christ. And we've all studied that, and we know what those events are. We've looked at them. We know them pretty well. So, as I looked at it, I thought, well, you know, again, bearing in mind that the intention of this series is not necessarily a review of history and of events and things like that, or even prophecy. But it's rather that we want to get the words of Christ, the things that He taught, and the impact of those words in us. So that's what I'm going to do as we go through this chapter. I'm going to focus mostly on the words of Yeshua that bear teaching or have a lesson in them, rather than going over every red letter statement in, you know, all the Gospels that just, you know, further the story or the timeline of the Passion, which again, you know, we all know pretty well. The first section of Christ's words that we find in Matthew 26 concern a little event that occurred, a story that we've looked at before. And, you know, the Gospel of Mark recounts this as well. Matthew 26 and verse 6, starting there, it says, "When Yeshua was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, a woman came to him having an alabaster flask of very costly fragrant oil, and she poured it on his head, and he sat at the table. And when his disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, 'Why this waste? For this fragrant oil might have been sold for much and given to the poor.' But when Yeshua was aware of it, he said to them, 'Why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a good work for me.' For you have the poor with you always, but me you do not have always. For in pouring this fragrant oil on my body, she did it for my burial. Assuredly, I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her. Now, I'm kind of hoping that you guys remember the impact of this story from a message I gave a while back entitled The Alabaster Flask. It was back in the spring of 2014, so it's been a while. But still, I've kind of expounded in depth on this little story, so I decided not to address it again. But there's a lot of really good information in there. There's a lot of good lessons in there. And so if you don't recall all of it, I'd encourage you to go back in the archives and listen to that message. And, you know, if you weren't here then, you know, by all means, you know, give it a shot. There's a very good reason why God saw fit to inspire this event to be in our Bibles. There's a lot of meat there, and there is a lot more to this than immediately catches the eye. It's no accident, I'll give you a hint, that this occurred right before, right as the passion was beginning, and before Judas made his final decision to go betray Yeshua. And as a matter of fact, that is what occurs in the very next verse here in Matthew 14, 26, verse 14. And it's also, the betrayal is the very next thing that occurs in Mark's account as well. So I'm going to encourage you to take a bit of time and go to that sermon archive and watch again the Alabaster Flask, because again, I'm not going to take the time here in this series to repeat it. I've already covered it. So as we move on in Matthew 26, Yeshua speaks some words to his disciples, giving them instructions on Passover. The Passover meal then begins. Yeshua exposes Judas as being the one that will betray him. And then Yeshua presents and explains the symbols of the bread and the wine, instituting what we call the New Testament Passover. And I'm going to skip over that as well today. Why? Well, we just came through the Spring Holy Days. We covered it at length. We covered it every year, really, during the Spring Holy Days. So I think that's covered pretty well. So I'm going to skip over that as well today. All right, after the Passover service was completed, okay, they left the upper room, and they went out to the Mount of Olives. And now we can kind of have that vision in our head, can't we? We can see where they came out, and they walked over to the Mount of Olives, and Yeshua said this, verse 31. He said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Now, I'm going to back up a little bit. Earlier in chapter 26, right when all this was starting, and he was explaining the Passover, you know, what's going to happen, he told them plainly that he would be delivered up and crucified. He told them what was going to happen this night. And he says, you'll be made to stumble because of me this night. That the sheep will be scattered, and after I've been raised, I'll go before you to Galilee. And Peter answered and said to him, even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. Yeshua said to him, assuredly I say to you this night, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. And Peter said, even if I have to die with you. So he knew what Yeshua had said was going to happen. He said, I will not deny you. And so said all the disciples. So there is a lot here that gives us a very important lesson, a lot that we can glean from this. And we're all familiar with the fact that Peter said, I'm not going to deny you three times. And then we're all familiar with how that worked out for him. You know, that indeed he did. And, what transpired the rest of that night. But I want you to notice something you might have read over before. Look again at verse 35. It says, and so said all the disciples. So said all the disciples. It wasn't just Peter. They all expressed their devotion to Yeshua, to stand with him that night, even unto death. All of them. Not just Peter. And yeah, we get the story that Peter failed and he denied Christ three times, but so did the other disciples. None of them stood with him. They all pledged to stand with him even unto death. Even if we have to die with you, we will not deny you. So said all the disciples. But we know the story, don't we? The only ones that were up there on that hill with Yeshua being crucified were two criminals. There were no disciples up there standing with him, right? Unto death. None of them, not just Peter, lived up to this pledge that they made to Yeshua. And it seems that they had an almost immediate lack of endurance with respect to this promise, with standing with Christ. Let's continue. We look at verse 36. Yeshua came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. Stay with me. And he took with him Peter and two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply depressed. And he said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me. And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. He knew what his situation was, and it was hard. It was tough. He says, nevertheless, though, not as I will, but as you will. And then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, what? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? He says, watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Again, a second time, he went away and prayed, saying, oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done. And he came and he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them and he went away again and prayed the third time, saying the same words. And then he came to his disciples and he said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand. The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise! Let's go. See, my betrayer is at hand. So we see that not only were the disciples unable to stand with Yeshua unto death, they weren't even able to support him enough to stay awake and pray for him as he faces this. He had clearly communicated to them that he was going to be betrayed, delivered up and crucified. It was made clear to them. And in response to this information, all of them had declared that they would stand with him, that they would not forsake him, they would not deny him. Yet in the face of this impending crisis, they couldn't even stay awake to pray for him, let alone stand with him as they had promised in crucifixion. There was no patience, no resolve in this face of adversity. want you to consider some of the things that we just read that Yeshua said. He says, pray that you may not enter into temptation. He knew what they were going to face. He said, why are you sleeping? Rise and pray. Again, lest you enter into temptation. This is, in other Gospels. We read in Matthew, what, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Come on. Come on, Cletus. Right? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. Stay here and watch with me. And are you still sleeping? The hour's at hand. When you put all this together, you get this picture of this weakness that Christ is seeing in these men, and you get a clarity of the message from Yeshua. Again, that he had told them what was going to happen. He told them he was going to be delivered up and crucified. That they had professed their allegiance to stand with him, but then they didn't even have the strength to stand with him enough to pray for him. And because of that, they became weak. He said, pray that you not enter into temptation. Well, they didn't pray, so they entered into temptation. They got weak. See? And then they all denied him. All of them. Now, there are some huge lessons in this for us, isn't there? When you accept Christ as your Savior, as your King and Lord, you are saying the exact same thing that these men said when they said, we will stand with you even unto death. Right? Isn't that what baptism pictured when you were baptized? Didn't it picture your willingness to bury the old man, to die with Christ? Of course it did. But then do we walk away, forgetting what we had promised? Are we willing to actually do it? Are we willing to stand with Christ in prayer for strength to avoid temptation? Can we wait with God? Can we wait for God? Just like these disciples were clearly shown what is about to happen, so are we, Christ's disciples, and we have been shown through the book of Revelation and other prophecies what is going to happen. Are you willing to stand and watch with God to trust what is coming, even unto death, like you promised at baptism, like you said you wanted? These words of Yeshua were spoken to his disciples. Again, you are a disciple. And I'd invite you to look up here and read these as if he is standing here saying them to you personally. He's telling you to pray that you may not enter temptation. He's telling you to rise from your slumber. He's telling you to watch with him. He's telling you to stay awake, to stay strong, and to wait on him in prayer. This is God talking to us. There must be perseverance, resolve, and patience as we wait on God. Now, I'll be the first to admit, I am not the most patient person. I'm not the second most patient person. In fact, most of the time I'm pretty lousy at it. Okay? I tend to be like the disciple that cut off the ear of the high priest. Remember that? That's part of this story too. You know, they go in there and one of the disciples says, I'm going to take care of this. And he draws his sword and cuts off the high priest's ear. You know, and Christ had to come and fix it. You know? But I mean, what was he doing? Was he waiting on God? No. He was taking matters into his own hands. You know, and that's me. And that's probably you. That's probably all of us, to one degree or another, at one time or another, if we're honest about it. We'll have a situation, we'll pray about it, and we'll kind of wait on God for a little bit, but you know, if he's just not quite getting it done, we get impatient and we take matters into our own hands and we pull our sword and we cut somebody's ear off. And then, you know, a lot of times Christ doesn't come and fix it. He teaches us a lesson, and we have to sit there and we have to deal with the situation, and we have to deal with a bloody mess now on top of what we already had because we weren't patient. I want you to think about a promise that was made to Abraham. Right? God said, you're gonna have a family. They're going to be like the sand of the seashore. And he waited. Well, ain't nothing happening. So what's he do? You know, Sarah gives him her handmaiden, and he does the work for God, you know, steps in. Made a huge mess. We are still to this day dealing with the lineage of that son. See evidence of it in Orlando just a couple weeks ago. It's alive and well. There's consequences, right? So we need to hear these words of Yeshua. And we need to be willing to stay awake, to stay alert, to pray. And when it's appropriate, we wait on God. We have to learn how to wait with God and wait for God. Because a lot of times, people, God's time frame is not the same as our time frame. He sees times a whole lot different than we do. And we see it in the Bible over and over again. Joseph, if you remember the story of him, he was betrayed by his brothers, and it was 13 years that he went through all of that before he took that leadership role in Egypt. Moses, you know, roamed the desert for 40 years, tending sheep before he was called back to Israel to help the people, you know, leave from slavery. David was told he would be anointed as king, but he fled from Saul for 14 years before he was finally anointed as the king of Israel. Are you willing to wait for God in the time that he wants you to? Just like the disciples were told what was to come, so are we. But they were also told to wait and to pray and get prepared for what was to come the rest of that night. Had they done that, they might have been able to stand with him. And we have to do the same. And while we're waiting, while we're doing that, we have to have the perspective that God is preparing us in that process. That it's not wasted time. Joseph, Moses, and David were all being prepared by God during those waiting years. They were all going through things that may have seemed insignificant. But by being faithful through them, they were building the skills. They were building the strength and the spiritual muscle that they needed later on to be able to fulfill their destiny. That future, you know, that God has for us. And that's the future that we need to have in our minds and put life in that context so that we can stay strong. It's that future that we need to be praying about and focusing on in order to be able to stay strong and be prepared. That future is amazing. Habakkuk 1:5 says, "Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe though it were told you." And one of my favorite scriptures, 1 Corinthians 2:9, "Eye has not seen or ear heard, nor have entered, hasn't even entered into the heart of man." You can't even conjure it up in your imagination, the greatness of the things that God has prepared for those who love Him. God has great things prepared for us in this life and in the resurrection. And in this life, we have to understand we go through these cycles. Sometimes we're in a cycle of waiting. And sometimes we're not. You know, we're kind of in the thick of it. And there's different aspects of our life that are in different cycles. And we have to learn that while we're in some of these waiting cycles, that we're to stay awake. You know, in the Bible, being awake is equated with righteousness. 1 Corinthians 15 says, "Awake to righteousness and don't sin. For some do not have the knowledge of God, and I speak this to your shame." Or this in Romans. "And do this, knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. For now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed." So the closer that we get to the second coming of Christ, the more urgent this call is to wake up, to be alert and be vigilant as we wait. And of course, this applies to the second coming, guys, but it also applies to our waiting on God in all sorts of circumstances in our lives, right? You know, sometimes we wait to be married. But as we're waiting to be married, we prepare ourselves. We get ready for that role that we're going to have in a family. We wait sometimes for a better job, and we have to endure maybe a bad boss or something. As we face these kind of things, we want to be cognizant of those situations and be praying about it. Be awake. Engage with God during those times. And I'm not saying that we don't do our part, that we just sit and we wait. That's not what I'm talking about. We want to do our part. But at the same time, we don't want to go make a bigger mess out of it and go cut off somebody's ear either, right? So what I'm saying is, while we wait, while we're in some of these cycles of preparation, we do a couple of things. We want to be thinking about preparing skills that will be needed to go forth once the wait is over. And secondarily, we want to be preparing our character by being patient during the waiting. You know, Paul said that he had learned to be content in all things. Remember? He said, I can abound and I can abase, right? I can be content with his application was, you know, I can be content in jail, I can be content free, I can be content rich, poor, whatever. He said he learned to be content in whatever circumstances he was faced with. And that's being patient, see, in the waiting. And there are many reasons why God asks us to wait. Because there are many things that are built during that process while we wait. And here's a few to chew on. Waiting reveals our true motives. Waiting is really hard sometimes, isn't it? You know, it can be a real source of stress, especially if you're waiting in the midst of a tough trial and you're looking for deliverance from that trial. And stress, see, always brings out either the best or the worst in a person. Remember back the equation I gave you at the feast several years ago? I think it was a couple years ago. That feast we had a focus on our eternal perspective. And I gave you an equation that would help you predict how you would come through a trial. We see people go through the exact same trial, and one person will have a completely different experience than another when the same thing. Because see, the stress of trials brings out the true motives, the true character, the true way that you react to things and deals with things. It shows where your reliance is, where your true trust lies. Does anybody remember the equation? What was it?
It was C plus E equals P, which is circumstance plus experience equals perspective.
Well, you're close. Very close. You got one transposed.
Circumstances plus
experience. There we go. C plus P equals E. Circumstances plus your perspective in those circumstances equals the experience that you're going to have in that circumstance. And so you can have two people go through the same set of circumstances, the same trial, and have in them a completely different outlook, a completely different viewpoint, a completely different perspective, and they will have a completely different experience in those same circumstances. So sometimes people go through the same circumstances many times. They go through them a lot of times. They keep repeating them until they can come through them with the right perspective and get the experience. And then usually when that happens, the circumstances don't appear again. So the waiting, right? The persevering in trials reveals our true motives and where our perspective is and creates the experience we will have in those circumstances. Waiting also builds patience, and I know this one's obvious, but we need to realize that building patience in small things allows us to have patience in bigger things. If we can't have patience for God in a little thing, how are we going to wait on Him for the larger things? Remember, Christ asked His disciples, "What? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Could you not at least do that one small thing?" I mean, He knew if they couldn't do that, there's no way they were going to stand with Him to crucifixion. They couldn't stand with Him for an hour and pray. So perspective here, again, is the key. Our circumstances can sometimes feel like huge things. Financial problems with all sorts of things, debt or whatever, problems with a job, you know, difficulties with our car or our house or whatever. But if our perspective is on eternal things, then those things shrink, don't they, in significance. And our experience in them changes. We find that we can have much more patience for all these small things when our perspective is eternal. As they shrink down. You know, I've told you about Mark several times. This guy used to live with us in Texas, and I've talked about him. He's the one that got run over by the semi and broke his neck and died 3 times and had a halo brace and screws drilled in his head and all sorts of things, and he came through it. And when I met that guy, he was in the most pathetic of circumstances. I mean, obviously, I mean, he came and lived with us for a while because he was down. But you couldn't have told it by talking to him. You couldn't have told it by being within 10 feet of that guy. He just eluded happiness in the midst of circumstances that would take other people and put them in a high depression. It was wonderful. He was inspiring. And I mean, this guy barely knew anything about God, but he had this wonderful perspective on life. He would always say to us, "Hey, don't sweat the small things." And then he'd follow up and he'd say, "And they're all small things. They're all small things." It's a good guy. Waiting builds anticipation. When we get things too quickly, we don't appreciate them. It's just true. I've experienced it. I've got a zillion examples of it in raising children, right? And I'll tell you, it's why giving your kids everything they want is a terrible form of child abuse. It's awful. Because it does not prepare them for the waiting of life. Of having to go and get something on their own and do it. You know, a lot of times if you give something to someone, it gets tore up. They don't appreciate it. They don't care for it. But you know, if they have to work for it, if they have to wait for it, if they have to build towards it, then they cherish it more. It gets more care. And I've seen it over and over. And while this example I'm giving is applying this principle to things, it also applies, guys, to character, to how we look at circumstances and how we react to blessings from God. They come when we have to wait for them, like God has us do sometimes. We appreciate them more when they come. Waiting transforms our character. See, all these things that we're talking about builds our character. It transforms us. And at the end of the day, that's what this life is all about. See, God can speak life into anything. Really, He can. He has. He does. He said, I can speak through a jawbone of an ass. He said, I can make these stones rise up and fight. I can, you know, He can speak life into anything immediately. But character has to be built. And that takes time. It takes time. It takes waiting on God in these situations. I want to say that waiting is kind of like the pressure of life, right? Pressure is what turns coal into diamonds over time. That's all diamond is carbon that has experienced tremendous amounts of pressure. So it turns something like that into a beautiful diamond over time. And God is creating a family, a nation that is going to be able to dwell together in harmony and productivity for eternity. And in order to create that kind of character, it takes a little time. It takes a little pressure. See, think about Moses. You know, he was in Egypt, right? And he saw the slaves, you know, being beat. And so he takes it upon himself to do something about it, doesn't he? He draws his sword and he kills one of the Egyptian soldiers. And then he tries to hide the body, but God doesn't let that happen. Of course, the body's found and he's exiled from Egypt, right? God had to take him out of there. And he tended sheep. He wandered in that desert. I've stood in that desert for 40 years. Right? 40 years of pressure. See? Molding him, shaping him, changing his character so that he wasn't reacting like that. He was learning to what? To wait on God. He was learning how to do things within God's time frame, in God's way. When we see that there's a way that we do things and we see that there's a way that God does things, we have to learn how to wait for God and not try to do it our way. And that's what God taught Moses in that wilderness. Waiting on Him prepared him to be able then to go back to Egypt, to not draw his sword and go after Pharaoh, but allow God to work through all the things that he did. See? And so waiting then builds intimacy and dependency on God. And of course, this is the big one, right? Everyone we read about that was successful in the Bible, they weren't that way from the start. They were just average, normal, sinning human beings with problems just like we have. But they all learned by having to wait on God that He's faithful. They all gained a relationship that was intimate with God by learning to become dependent on Him. And they got that way through waiting. Waiting during the difficult times developed their dependency on God, their relationship with God, their trust in God. Some of the most intimate relationships we have in our lives are because a friend stood in the gap with us during a tough time. And maybe that's what the scripture means in Proverbs somewhere when it says we have a friend that is what, greater than or stronger than a brother, or sticks closer than a brother, I think it says. The reason that we get to read these stories of these great men and women in the Bible is because they went through the difficulties of life and they went through them with God. In the end, they enjoyed the process with God and the promises of God. God, I think, is just as interested in the journey as He is in the destination. Because it's in the journey that He's accomplishing His ultimate goal, and that is creating within us His character. You know, if that wasn't the case in all of these biblical accounts, we wouldn't have the whole story. We wouldn't see all the, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly with all these guys. We just see the end part. But that's not the way it is. And we may not always understand why we have to wait. But the good news is this, that God never asks us to wait without Him. I'm going to repeat that. We may not always understand why we have to wait. But the good news is God never asks us to wait without Him. Okay? And because of that, it builds this relationship, this intimacy, this trust and dependency that we can have on God. I hope this helps you understand and take to heart the perspective that Yeshua gives us. It was illustrating to us with these words to His disciples. We need to take each of them to heart. We need to stay awake. We need to pray and strengthen our trust and build into intimacy with God as you wait. During trials and even in just the little things of your daily life. And by doing so, the disciples, all of them, you know, maybe could not have failed that night. Maybe some of them could have stayed awake. But none of them did. Why? Because none of them prayed. None of them tapped into the power and the strength to stand with Him as He was accused. Certainly none of them stood with Him unto death as they said they would. None of them met the circumstance with an eternal perspective. See? And so they all had the same experience. They all failed. Now I'm going to ask you a question. What would the reward have been if one of those disciples had actually done it? What if they'd actually stood up and said, "Yes, I'm His disciple. Yes, I believe He's the Son of God. Yes, I stand with Him." Wow. What would that have been like? What would the reward have been like had there been four people on that hill? One or two or more disciples on a stake as well. Think about that. What if? I don't know. But I think it'd be pretty huge myself, right? I mean, we don't know for certain, but we could imagine. They all had that opportunity. They all said that they would do it. They all said, each and every one of them, they said, "Even if I have to die, I will not deny you." So said all the disciples, that they would die with Him. Now, what reward would they have had received had they followed through with that? Just something that, you know, I mean, it'd been incredible. Can you imagine? What if you'd had the chance? Would you have been able to do it? What if your perspective had been so clear in the eternal, in the spirit, that you could have faced that same set of circumstances that Christ was facing and got through them the same way he did and ended up on that stake and shared that experience with Christ. Might not have been real fun at the time. Christ didn't think it was fun. He said, Father, if it's possible that this cup pass from me, please. 3 times he went. He didn't think it was fun. But he had an eternal perspective, didn't he? He looked past those circumstances to what God had laid before him. And what if they had done the same? What would you have been able to? Now, what if I told you that you have that opportunity? Because you do. God offered it to you when he called you to himself, called you to baptism. By getting baptized, you have said exactly what Peter and all of the disciples said right here in verse 35. You have the opportunity to live your life with that perspective, to see your circumstances in that light, and to make real the blessings of the result of having that sort of experience in those circumstances. And how do we do that? We do it the same way that Christ did. We don't follow the example of the disciples. We do what Christ did. The power of God's Spirit in Christ led him to pray. It led him to trust in the Father. It led him to wait on him. He had built an intimacy with the Father, and he modeled it that night, going over and over, 3 times off by himself to pray. He hated the circumstance. He wanted it to pass from him, but trusting the Father, waiting for his deliverance in the Father's time, according to the Father's timetable and not his own, and according to the Father's way that he would deliver him through a resurrection. He said, not my will, but yours be done. His perspective carried him past the pain of the circumstance to an awesome experience. And during the same time of waiting, what did the disciples do? They slept. While they slept, Yeshua prepared. Yeshua prayed. Yeshua gained perspective and trust and confidence in the waiting. And when the pressure came on the disciples, what did they do? They denied him. They caved in. But when it came on Yeshua, he stood strong. Look here, verse 63. He was being questioned. He was being, okay, now you're called on the carpet. Here's the time. This is it. I mean, when the disciples were approached and they said, hey, do you know this guy? Oh, no, I don't know. But when Yeshua was pressed in front of the authorities, it says he kept silent. And then the high priest answered and said to him, I put you under the oath by the living God. Tell us if you are Christ, the Son of God. And Yeshua said to him, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. He stood strong. He stood strong. See, the circumstances for the disciples and for Yeshua were not completely identical, but they were similar. Forces had come against this group, right? This was a revolution that was occurring. Now, Christ was the head of it, and there was these men that were behind him, and they were this group. And that the force of evil was coming against them, challenging them what they were doing. And the disciples said, we'll stand with you. Even unto death, we'll stand there with you. And so these circumstances that came were, you know, should have been shared by them all. They all were facing the same circumstance. Christ was able to see. He was able to keep his eternal perspective. He was able to see past it that they were not. Okay? And so they had a completely different experience. Their experience led them to shame and to regret. And Christ's experience led him to sit down at the right hand of the Father. So I ask, are we praying through our trials? Are you awake? Awake to righteousness while you are waiting for God? Are you building intimacy with God so that you can have trust and confidence in Him when the heat and the pressure is on? Are you able to maintain your eternal perspective in the midst of what seems like drastic, stressful circumstances? Because it's going to be required of you at some point. In little ways and then bigger ways. So let's take the time to really kind of think about this very poignant example, if you ask me, that we have here. And allow it to change us, to change our mind, to transform our mind, to mold us into better disciples that are prepared to stand with Christ no matter the circumstances. Amen?
Amen. Amen.